Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, December 10th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. All right, guys, I want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. Remember, there's a bunch of ways to support the show, but it really heavily relies on listener support, and I use Patreon in order to facilitate that process. So if you go to patreon.com/talknerdy, you can pledge your support and help this independent podcast stay alive. Can you believe that we are 237 episodes in? That's a really big deal, and it's all because of support from listeners just like you. I want to give a shout out to my top supporters this week. They include Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Hermio Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. But remember, that's not the only way to support the show. There's a lot you can do. You can tell your friends and family about it. You can share on social media. You can go to iTunes or Google Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can rate and review. And the other thing that you can do, and it's really exciting, is you can visit the new and improved Talk Nerdy store by going to talknerdymerch.com. And there I've got all sorts of stuff, t-shirts and mugs and tote bags. And I actually have copies of both of the books I was involved in this year, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which I co-wrote. You can buy a signed copy there. It makes a great holiday gift. And the National Geographic Almanac 2019. I wrote the foreword to that book, and I also am the quiz master. So I pop up throughout the book at the beginning of the sections and kind of ask you some trivia to carry you throughout. Signed copies of that. I can subscribe or transcribe. Nope, neither of those words is the word I'm looking for. I can make them out to whomever you would like. Just denote that when you make the order. There's also really great new merch that features my little man, Killer the Science Dog. Super cute. Check it out at talknerdymerch.com. Okay, enough about me. Let's talk about my guest this week. It was an absolute honor and privilege to sit down with this inspiring and brilliant and incredibly humble individual. So I have to kind of give a little bit of background. I went to Cambridge a few months ago, along with the Skeptic's Guide, because we were on the book tour. And we were getting a tour of Cambridge, and I had been speaking with the publicist for this individual in advance, and they were like, oh, you're going to be in England. Why don't you just pop in? So I had the honor to visit this individual. The reason I haven't said his name yet is because I have to tell you a funny story. I walked into his beautiful historic office, and I told him, or I asked him, I'm not sure which title supersedes. Is it Dr. Martin Rees or is it Sir Martin Rees? And his response, I still remember it, was like, well, Lord supersedes all of those things. And I was like, oh crap. So I hadn't gotten the memo, but yes, he is Lord Martin Rees, Baron Rees of Ludlow, and has a ton of titles after that. Notably Astronomer Royal. He was the Master of Trinity College, Cambridge from 2004 to 2012, and President of the Royal Society between 2005 and 2010. Guys, this is a big deal. He wrote a beautiful new book called On the Future, Prospects for Humanity. His previous books were Our Cosmic Habitat, Just Six Numbers, and Our Final Hour. But his new book, it's actually very short and sweet. I highly recommend it. It's a quick read and an important read. It's not about astronomy. It's not about physics. It's about where we're going. It really talks about the existential risks that we're facing as a human society. It talks about foibles, you know, the short-term thinking, polarization, alarmist rhetoric, cynicism, all of the things that we are really struggling with at the governmental level, but also at the individual level. And I think that this book actually will give you a lot of hope. There's humor, there's perspective, there's deep reverence and absolute brilliance contained within his pages. It's pages. It's pages. So guys, without any further ado, I just feel like I'm not going to do it service. You've just got to hear the interview. Again, like I said, it was an absolute honor, an absolute privilege. So here he is, Lord Martin Rees. Well, Martin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, good to be with you.
And I feel absolutely honored. I am so excited. I'm sitting here in your office at Trinity College at Cambridge. It's beautiful here.
It is lovely and great privilege to be here. And the court where you're sitting looked the same when Newton was here.
Oh, that's incredible.
And he was our best student. It's been downhill ever since.
And so how long have you been associated with Cambridge? Are you a professor emeritus now?
I guess I am, yes. And I've been in Cambridge for more than 30 years in various capacities. I was professor, I was head of the Institute of Astronomy, and then I was the master of Trinity College, which is a sort of head person in the college.
And now you are Astronomer Royal.
Well, that's an honorary title, really. It doesn't mean very much.
I think it probably means something to the rest of the world.
Well, a bit of background on it. It was the name given to the person who ran the Greenwich Observatory, which was a national observatory set up in 1675, supported by the government. Mm-hmm. To do navigation and the calendar and all that. And that observatory at Greenwich continued until about 1960. But then it became possible to do astronomy from high-altitude sites in the Canary Islands, Hawaii and Chile, etc. And there was no point in having good telescopes in London. And so the museum there became a museum. And the title then was used as an honorary title like Poet Laureate.
Is the Greenwich Observatory, I was told by someone who lives in Greenwich that it's the only observatory in London. Is that true?
It's not quite true. It's it's the main one. I know one of the university college has an observatory of its own, so there are some others. Yeah. And I think some amateurs will have them, but it's a famous historic place, of course.
And it's, of course, where you can stand right on the...
On the meridian, yes.
On the meridian.
And yes, one leg in each hemisphere.
Yes, of course. Incredible. Yeah. So you have recently authored a new book. How many books have you written to this point?
I've written about 8 books. Six of them have been on astronomy and things related to astronomy, but 2 have been rather more general on the future and politics and concerns. And this new book, it covers lots of topics about what's going to happen in this century and what scientists in particular can do about it. And, of course, when I tell people I'm an astronomer royal, they somehow think, am I the person who does the Queen's horoscopes?
Oh, no.
And I have to say, well, I don't, and I'm not an astrologer, so my crystal ball is very cloudy. And so when I talk about the future, obviously, one can't always be confident about what one says, but there's some things we can say. I think we can say the population of the world will be higher by 2050. We can say the world will be warmer by 2050. But as to what the key technologies will be, we can extrapolate. But I think if we realize just how magic smartphones would have seemed just 25 years ago, we have no idea what will be the dominant technologies by 2050 and beyond. So any projections beyond 2050 become very uncertain in many respects.
It really is, you know, for so long, we were really looking at technological advance almost in a linear way. And now, of course, with, I guess they call it Moore's Law, this idea that it's almost logarithmic, the increases. And like you said, after 2050, it's maybe fantastic to us, the types of technology that we would be capable of. But also, something that's very important that you point out in your book, the ethical use of these technologies is something that we must always be mindful of.
Well, that's right. The technology is getting more powerful. And one thinks of not just AI and computing, but bio, cyber, and space technology. All these things are getting more powerful. And they have more capacity for doing good. But the downside of that is they can cause catastrophe more effectively than any previous technology. And so the challenge is, of course, to ensure that we can continue to responsibly innovate so that we get the benefits and minimize the risk of the downside, which, as you say, are getting more and more threatening because these technologies are more powerful. And in particular, we've now got to a situation when a few people, or even one person, can cause really catastrophic broad-scale damage, even global damage. We know what a cyber attack can do already if you shut down the electric grid of a city or something of that kind. So bio threats of that kind will be equally serious. If you can engineer a virus and spread that, that could be devastating. So we have to worry about the misuse of these technologies by error or by design. But I don't want to be a Luddite and say we've got to stop them. We've got to harness them as well as we can and regulate them as well as we can. But the worry is we can't always enforce the regulation. So I do worry a bit about us having a bumpy ride through this century in that it's so easy for things to go wrong. And also, if something goes wrong, we're so interconnected that it can cascade globally.
Absolutely. You know, I often think about kind of the Great War or World War II. We glamorize these eras. We think about, let's say, the Manhattan Project, for example, and the scientists who were really struggling with the ethical implications of the work that they were doing. And I think that's a very obvious example from history that's quite large and pointed. But as we look to current technology, there's kind of a small trickle. There's no one person that we think of as being in charge. And it becomes quite difficult to talk about regulation. I came across an article just this week about a question about whether or not scientists should sign some sort of Hippocratic oath, the way that physicians do, that more and more commonly individual research technologies, methodologies could have these widespread global implications. Do you think it's a good idea for a working lab scientist to sign an oath at the beginning of their, let's say, PhD thesis that says, I will do my science only for good?
Well, it may be, but even if they don't sign something, I mean, that should be their attitude. And you mentioned the people who built the first nuclear weapons scientists, and I knew some of them in their later years, and they were really great people. And several of them went back to civilian life and academic work after the war, but they saw it as their obligation to do what they could to help control the powers they had helped unleash. And they did their best through arms control efforts. They weren't very successful, but they fell with their obligation. And I think they thereby set a model which should, as you imply, be followed by scientists who do anything that has any kind of societal impact, and to make sure that if it has benefits, commercial or public, they should ensure that at least someone exploits them, even if they don't. And if there's a downside, they should warn the public and politicians against it and do what they can. So scientists do have a special obligation, I think, because they'll be the first to realize what this is, and also ethical implications. I know in our country we have quite a good record of people in biomedicine having a dialogue with parliamentarians about embryo research and issues like that. And I think that's very important that that should happen.
And of course, in our country, we are well known for the ban that was placed several years ago on embryonic stem cell research. We're well known for a lot of policy that's absolutely not evidence-based, kind of a lack of communication between government leaders and scientists. I don't think we have an appointed scientist that the president speaks to at this point.
Obviously. You do have one now.
We do, finally.
Surprisingly good, given what he's up against.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. But we
But it's true that that's a problem. But two things. I think, first, you were saying how bad the United States was, and it is in general. But there's one context where we were worse, and that was in GM crops, where what happened was that a standoff between the environmentalists and Monsanto came about before the debate. And so certainly in Europe, there have been, I think, unduly severe constraints on GM crops, unaware of the fact that some huge control experiment done for 10 years when 300 million Americans have eaten this stuff with no manifest harm attributable to it.
Yeah.
So I think that's one case where we did a bad job compared to America. But on the whole, I think we've done quite a good job.
It's interesting you point that out. You know, we're here, I'm here with the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe on our book tour, and we are going to be speaking to the Cambridge skeptics tonight. And we were saying, you know, what are the sacred cows? What are some of the buttons that we can probably push?
Yes.
And the organizers were saying GMOs, even the people within the skeptic societies here are still a bit cagey about genetic research or genetic modification of crops. So it is funny. We see those sacred cows. We're seeing an anti-vax movement growing both in America and in Europe. Which is just, it's just stunning. Do you think it's a function of the progress that we've made, that there's kind of a sense of security that people have? Maybe they've never seen polio, young mothers and fathers, and that's why they feel, oh, I don't need to vaccinate.
No, I think that that is true, because and they also perhaps are not public-spirited enough, because obviously if everyone has a vaccine except your kid, then you are got a slightly lower risk for your kid. I think people are less public-spirited, but also there is this lack of trust, which is sort of fueled by some of the media. So I think that is a problem. But I think going back to science advice, I think all scientists do have an obligation. And I think the scientists who work in government, like the recently appointed advisor to Trump, I think they will be frustrated about how little impact they make. That's because politicians, understandably, have a focus on the short term and the national and what happened before the next election, etc. Whereas many of the issues where the science is important, GM crops, climate, environment, energy, health, things like that, they are long term and they have to be tackled internationally. And so, understandably, they slip down the agenda. In fact, well, a European politician said, we know what we should do. We don't know how to get re-elected when we've done it. And that's a big inhibition for politicians. And that's why, incidentally, I think scientists can often have a bigger effect by being campaigners rather than being within a government department. Because politicians will take notice of what's in their inboxes and what's in the press. So if public interest and concern is raised about some issue, then that will cause politicians to take it up. And I think thereby it's the people who have the influence on public opinion who probably can do more good in these contexts than someone in government. And if we think of big campaigns in the past in the United States, think of anti-slavery, black power, gay rights and things, they all started with a few committed, charismatic people, but then they became widespread and then they became part of the consensus and politicians only then took them seriously. And to quote a more recent example in this country, one of the most admired people in the country is David Attenborough for the nature picture. And of course, and climate change, this is the iconic picture of the polar bear on the little bit of ice, etc. But just last year, there was another series of programs called Blue Planet 2, and there were some iconic pictures showing an albatross returning after foraging in the Southern Ocean over thousands of miles with food for its infants and coughing up bits of plastic and not the food. And that's a kind of iconic image, which, like the polar bear, will have an effect. And certainly in this country, there's been much more concern about non-recyclable plastics than there was just a year or two ago. And I think it's Attenborough's program, which has done far more than any internal political advisor.
You're absolutely right. I mean, and it's so, I think to me, being in America, working as a full-time science communicator now, having left academia, I'm actually back in now, but for quite a while, for a decade, working as a public science communicator, it's refreshing to me to hear somebody of your influence, of your status, of your knowledge speaking this way, because I do think that within American academic circles, and I wonder if it's similar here in the UK, there's a bit of a maybe an age divide about public science communication, you see some of the older professors and researchers really pushing against it in their students and saying, no, 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 you don't want to self-promote, you know, don't talk about politics, stick to the science, and don't speak with journalists. And it's really disheartening.
Does that still happen? Because you've got some very fine examples, you know, Sagan himself, E.O. Wilson, and lots of other people like that.
Absolutely, yeah. Neil Shubin, Neil deGrasse Tyson. We have wonderful examples. Yeah, yeah. Hopefully more women soon. Mm-hmm. Hopefully more people of color. Mm-hmm. But there is a bit of a resistance within academia to sort of, I guess there's a push to keep politics and science quite separate.
Yes.
But really what we need right now is politically minded scientists.
That's right. And I would say that the ones in academia and the entrepreneurs are the ones who can do this most easily. Those who are constrained are people who are in some very large corporation and those who are in government. But it's the academics and the independent entrepreneurs, they're the ones who should speak out.
So speaking of the kinds of the futuristic ideas in the book, this idea of the technologies that could potentially really address some global struggles, but that also could potentially be a bit, what's the word I'm looking for? Cataclysmic. What kinds of technologies would you lump into that category?
As being dangerous.
As potentially being both.
Well, I think most of them are both. That's the point. I mean, obviously, gene modification has benign effects, but it could be used in a dangerous way. Gene drive, where you drive extinction of species in a way that has ecological damage that wasn't predicted. That's just one example.
Or eugenics, right?
And also
bringing that back.
If it becomes possible, not just to do single gene editing, but to identify and edit a combination of genes that affects other human characteristics, then that'll lead to ethical
Absolutely.
Concerns about a new, more fundamental kind of inequality, and we have to decide how to cope with it. So I think that all these technologies have benign and worrying consequences, obviously that's true of the cyber world. I mean, I think the internet has been a huge benefit, but it allows a new type of crime in a way that wasn't possible before, by connecting people up and making us all vulnerable to a single cyber attack.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with QuickStart. I know that you guys have been getting excited about QuickStart because I've been talking about it now for a couple of months. Oh my gosh, yummy snacks made with cricket powder. They taste super good. They're really good for you. And guys, they're like sustainable. They're good for the earth. Cricket powder. It's made from, I'm going to say it, free-range crickets, but also seed butters, hemp, chocolate, dates, super yummy stuff. So let's talk about them. They are really tasty. I mean, I think that's the number one. That's like the most important thing, is that they actually taste good. And we've got lots of options here with QuickStart. We've got these cool cricket flour crackers, and we've also got these super yummy cricket flour protein bar, so they're really good on the go. You've got complete nutrition. They don't have refined sugars in them. And they don't have that like weird chalky, chewy texture that a lot of protein bars have. You know, a lot of people don't like that, and you don't have to deal with that with QuickStart. But I mean, the most important thing for me is that these QuickStart bars are a way to really give back. They're a way to show that you are concerned about sustainability. You're concerned about the future of the planet. There are 40 crickets in every QuickStart bar, and there are over 100 crickets in every cracker bag. Get this, for the same amount of protein compared to beef, crickets require 12 times less feed, 2,000 times less water, thousands of times less land, and they emit 100 times less greenhouse gas. If there's any reason for you to try them, that's it right there. So guys, what are you waiting for? Go to QuickStart.com. You'll get 20% off your order if you use the promo code NERDY. Again, that's QuickStart.com, and you'll get 20% off with the promo code NERDY. I also want to thank Pimsleur for their support of the show. Remember, Pimsleur is the conversational method for learning a new language that was developed by Dr. Pimsleur, P-I-M-S-L-E-U-R, an applied linguist and professor at UCLA and Ohio State. The important thing about Pimsleur and what makes it really, really different is that it's all about conversational skills, you know, the stuff you'll actually use. And you learn by conversing and training your ears to understand native speakers. For me, when I'm trying to learn a new language, that's always been the hardest part. I might be good at reading it, I might be good at writing it, but I can't hear it. And Pimsleur helps with that. 75% of customers of Pimsleur can learn a new language on the go because you don't have to go and sit back down in front of your computer. You can do it on your mobile phone using the app. You could get to intermediate level in just 30 days, you guys. That's a really big deal. I know it wouldn't be the end of your language learning journey, but it's pretty cool to be an intermediate speaker and listener within just 30 days. A lot of people using Pimsleur because it works. The FBI, Homeland Security, the State Department, the Marines, the Navy, ton of Fortune 500 companies, diplomats, journalists, aid workers, business executives, you name it. And don't just take my word for it. You can try the full course absolutely free for 7 days, guys. This is risk-free. You don't have anything to lose by trying, but you have everything to gain. A new language, a new perspective, a better understanding of other cultures. We know how important that is. We talk about it all the time on Talk Nerdy. And right now, you, the listeners of Talk Nerdy, can go to pimspeaks.com/nerdy in order to take advantage of this free trial for 7 days. Now, that's P-I-M. pimspeaks.com/nerdy. One more time, absolutely free for 7 days, risk-free at pimspeaks.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. When we look about energy consumption worldwide, which is a, you know, a massive stress on the global population, we know that we need energy, and we know that we're going to be continuing to stress our resources because the population is exploding. And we see a lot of resistance in America to nuclear energy. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you see as well in the UK, or on the whole, are people quite accepting of nuclear power?
Well, I think there's ambivalence here, but it's as much because of the extreme cost as about the dangers. I mean, so it's both things. But I do think that we've got to explore new designs for nuclear, just as we should explore improvement in all kinds of carbon-free energy, solar, wind, and all the rest. And indeed, I think this is the one win-win situation if we want to cut carbon emissions, because if you just have a carbon tax, etc., it won't be fully effective. But if, in fact, you can ensure that carbon-free energy, and I would include fourth-generation nuclear in this, can be done economically, then it'll be helpful to countries like the US and Europe, but also, even more so, to a country like India, where at the moment they don't use much energy, but they just have smoky stoves burning wood and dung in people's homes, and they need a grid. And what they're going to do, if nothing else changes, is to have coal-fired power stations importing cheap coal from Australia. But what we'd like to see happen, obviously, is for the cost and efficiency of some kind of clean energies to drop, to be competitive with coal. And that's why, if that can be done, it's a win-win situation, because those who develop the technology will benefit, and India will be able to leapfrog directly to carbon-free energy. So I would say that one of the most important things we can do to address climate change is simply to accelerate R&D into energy, closer to the level of R&D into medical research, for instance. And that, I think, is very effective. The other win-win situation, obviously, is economizing on energy. And if we can do all those things, then 9 billion people can live comfortable lives. Maybe not quite the lives that wealthy Americans do now, not using as much energy, not eating so much beef, perhaps, but having a decent life. And incidentally, that reminds me that one very benign technology, in my opinion, is developing artificial meat.
Yes.
Which Of course, the sort of low-tech versions of that are available now, but really high-tech versions where you actually grow the whole thing from one cell is possible. And that's, again, a kind of research I prioritize.
I absolutely agree. I am a massive fan of the Impossible Burger, which has really caught on in America, which is artificial meat with heme in it, so it tastes quite like meat. But yes, lab-grown meat, it's going to change the game, hopefully, because that is a huge problem.
Well, not only can it feed the world with less carbon, but also one hopes eliminate factory farming, which is one of the great evils of our age.
Yes, it will hopefully produce necessary, perhaps even arable land to plant crops, but also you're right. I mean, it's such an ethical issue that so many people are willing to look past simply because their needs are greater in their view than the needs of kind of what they might consider lesser creatures. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big struggle in general. It's kind of a you know, I study psychology now. I was studying neuroscience and I've moved to psychology, and I'm quite interested in why people do the things they do and make the decisions that they make. Mm-hmm. And this kind of comes back to the conversation we were having previously about the fact that we think in the short term. Mm-hmm. You know, I always use the example of satellites and space debris, that we are so quick to get we figured out how to do this, let's throw them up there, but we never quite thought about how we were what we were going to do with them after
that. And of course nuclear waste is another example, isn't it?
And there's so many examples when you really start to dig about us trying to, and it's twofold, right? It's rush to the technology without thinking about the implications. But on the flip side of that, it goes hand in hand with exactly what you said, which is that politicians are concerned about the next 2 years, the next 4 years, whatever their term might be.
And of course, most investors are concerned only about the next 20 years.
Yeah, or even the next quarter.
That's right. And so in addressing climate change, you've got to think through the life cycle of babies born now who'll be alive in the 22nd century and realize it's worth paying an insurance premium now to remove the disaster which a worst-case climate scenario would otherwise cause by then.
And of course, you know, the $20,000 question is, what do we do when there are people in power who appear to be fundamentally denying science? When there are people who are motivated by completely different interests and who are actually developing a social program and influencing, you know, the citizens to distrust the institutions of science that they've for generations trusted. It's so frustrating when you see the solution to a problem. We have the technology to solve many problems, but we just don't have the political will. You know, how do we approach that?
Well, of course, it's got to come from the public, I think, and from the press, which ought to rubbish crazy views from politicians whenever possible, so that they can do more. But I think it's got to be the public. And thinking long term is one thing, but also thinking of issues which aren't immediately apparent. I mean, factory farming is an example. It's all hidden away. But in the case of climate change, one has to realize that the worst effects will happen not in countries like mine and yours, where we can cope with it fairly well, but in places like Africa, where they're very impoverished and can't cope with it. So one has to bear in mind that what we're doing is mainly for the benefit of future generations in remote parts of the world, and that's a doubly difficult ask of politicians. Here, incidentally, I think the religions can help, because I mentioned in my book that the Pope's encyclical in 2015, which was the first statement by a pope that we had a duty to the non-human environment and discuss climate change, that had a big effect on politicians and public in Latin America, Africa, and East Asia, and eased the path to consensus in the December 2015 climate conference. And what everyone thinks of the Catholic Church, you can't deny its global reach, its long-term vision, and that it cares about the world's poor. And so that's an example where somebody outside normal politics had a big enough effect on public opinion to affect politicians, because 1 billion followers collectively have lots of votes.
And it's just so insightful. You know, working within kind of the skeptic community and the science communication community, so often I think that we divide ourselves as secular individuals, you know, as non-believers, as atheists, and really almost scoff at individuals who are believers. It's we're harming ourselves in doing that, aren't we?
Well, I think so. But also I think you've got to realize that you can't get ethics from science.
Yeah.
I mean,
although there are many people who want who are writing books about it currently.
The great philosopher David Hume said, you can't get an ought from an is.
Yeah.
And that was true 300 years ago. It's still true now. So you've got to get ethical principles from somewhere. And some get it from religion. Some get it from other principles and other things they value. Straight science doesn't directly give you a value system, although it does, of course, tell you how you can achieve whatever values you aspire to.
It's interesting because that kind of brings us full circle to some of the things we were saying right at the beginning. You know, we've often, I think, historically divided, let's say, for example, biology, and let's say we'll divide that into basic and applied research.
Yes.
And then we have the bioethicists down the hall. So I want to do science for the sake of science. I'll let them worry about the implications of my work. Are you proposing that every single person at the individual level who studies science should also be well-versed in the ethical implications of the work that they do?
Well, I think they should be exposed to it. As part of the education of students. I mean, already if you're a medical student, you could get courses of this kind. But I think that there is, and in fact, in our university, they've started courses for mathematicians, where so many of them are going to end up in hedge funds, will be sort of ripping off the rest of us by what they're doing. And so they need a bit of ethical guidance there. And so I think it's important that most people should have some sort of ethical guidance to help them in their career choice. And therefore, one should acclaim these organizations like the effective altruism movements, and there's one called 80,000 hours, that being the number of working hours in your lifetime, which is in the UK. And these are encouraging because they at least mean that a lot of students do have these concerns. And of course, they will be alive the next 60 to 80 years. And so it's not surprising they have a longer term view than middle-aged people. But it's very good that there are these discussions. And I certainly think that as part of everyone's education, they should be exposed to views on ethics. They won't necessarily agree. They may get some religious views. They may have the views of people like the effective altruism people or Peter Singer, who are very good, but they're sort of extreme utilitarians of a 19th century kind who don't accept any other values apart from happiness. So that can be criticized. But there should be a debate about this sort of thing so that people no longer talk about scientific ethics as though science gives you a unique set of ethical guidelines, which it doesn't.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's quite breathtaking that when a student works towards a PhD, especially in a scientific field, a natural science field, a social science field, for example, or life science field, not much philosophy in their training.
Right.
And don't you think that if we did study, I was lucky enough to be a philosophy minor, and I think that absolutely set me on a course where my education was much more well-rounded.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not everybody has that opportunity.
Mm, yes. Well, I mean, I think it should happen formally, and certainly in this university, Cambridge, where I work, there is a lot of interest in the student body. In fact, I'm involved in a center for studying extreme risks, and we have lots of student interest. And in fact, some of our students, in fact, managed to start a parliamentary committee on future generations as a way of sort of promoting concern on longer term issues of that kind. And so there's a lot of political concern, which is very welcome indeed in a student body. And indeed, students are privileged in a way. They have more chance to talk and to meet philosophers, etc. But I certainly agree that this is something which is more and more important, because as science advances, and I think particularly of biomedical sciences and AI, then new issues arise. I mean, in biomedical science, clearly the issues about human enhancement and Now, the gap between when people will die naturally and when they could die if you give extreme treatment to them, that's mm-hmm. getting wider. And similarly, ultra-premature, your babies can be kept alive, etc. There needs to be a proper discussion about what should be done and what should be left to nature. And everyone should join into that discussion. And, of course, in AI, there are going to be lots of economic concerns, as we know, about what it'll do to the labour market and can we tax the robot owners enough to set up huge numbers of jobs for carers, for old people, teaching assistants, gardeners in public parks, and all the things that make life better, but which are done better by humans than by machines. We need to address that sort of issue, in my opinion. And also, if we think further ahead to when we have human-like, humanoid robots,
yeah.
we have to ask the question, are they zombies or are they thinking? Are they conscious? Because if they're conscious,
then
of course we have to care about their welfare,
exactly.
make sure they're not bored, because we think it's important that other humans and even some animals should be allowed to fulfill their potentialities. So should we worry if our robots don't? That's an important question. And then, of course, if you have issues like whether we can augment our brains electronically or download our brains, we have all these issues of human identity. I mean, if your brain was downloaded to a machine, or you said that had happened, would you be happy to be destroyed? Would that really be you? And supposing that you can download it and make 10 clones of it, which one will be you? These are issues that philosophers have debated for ages, but they're now becoming part of practical ethics.
Oh, it's incredible. I remember I had a moment early on in my career where I was sitting there talking to two astronauts about how they would prepare to go to Mars. And I had a moment saying, like, we might actually go to Mars in my lifetime.
Yes, yes.
This is absolute fiction, absolute science fantasy, and it's become a reality. And it just, every day it blows my mind. And I hope I never lose that. You know, I hope I never get complacent about that. So I do want, I'm about to close, but I have one final question before my two closing questions.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you think, let's see if I can ask this clearly, if this is a column A, a column B, or a both scenario. I'm noticing more and more astronomers, theoretical physicists, astrophysicists, who are starting to write about deep kind of philosophical existential issues. If you look at Stephen Hawking's posthumous book that was just recently published, he's talking about these big existential issues. A friend of mine who we've had on the show before, Sean Carroll, his most recent book.
His book is wonderful.
It's wonderful and it's very philosophical.
Yep.
And
very good book.
Seeing this change, and I'm wondering, do you think it's a function of the lifespan? Do you think it's a function of the era we're living in today, or is it a little bit of both?
Well, I mean, it's not that new, because, I mean, one of my predecessors as professor here, Arthur Eddington, wrote books of just that type in the 1930s and had a very wide reach. So there's nothing new about that. But I think it's the case that certain sciences lend themselves more to these sort of speculations. I mean, astronomy and cosmology is clearly one of them. Brain research is clearly another, whereas dentistry isn't. And so I think it's not surprising that people in these fields, they think about these. And of course, there is a public interest. And I think whereas some scientists grumble that the public is not interested in their work, I'm gratified that so many people are interested in things far away from everyday concerns, like the origin of the universe, black holes and the Higgs boson and all that, and of course, most of all, in dinosaurs. Completely irrelevant, but fascinating, above all other topics, to young kids.
Showing him my Archaeopteryx tattoo
So I think it is important, and so I think it's good that many professional scientists and indeed many professional communicators are meeting this need through the books and other media.
Hear, hear. I absolutely agree. Well, Martin, I always close my episodes. I know that you have to run. You have such a packed schedule. I always close my episodes by asking my guest the same two questions. And my listeners would be infuriated if I didn't do the same with you.
Yes.
So here they are, the quite big picture.
Yes.
You think about these things all the time.
Yes.
So when you look to the future, as you did throughout your entire book, in whatever context is relevant to you right now, you know, the future of humanity, the future of the universe, or just the future of you yourself, your family, your legacy, Number one, what is the thing, if you had to pick one, that really does keep you up at night, that really concerns you, that you almost are feeling a bit maybe pessimistic or cynical about? But then on the flip side of that, so we end on a bit of a lighter note, what is the thing that you genuinely, truly are optimistic about? It's not lip service. You really do have an optimistic view of the future.
Yes. Well, first, the pessimism, which is fairly short term, it is that the world is becoming less governable, and more and more people are embittered. And if we take people in countries like Africa, where they're disadvantaged, two things have changed. They know what they're missing because they all have mobile phones, etc. And mobility is greater. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to have big shifts due to that, and big risks of some sort of high consequence, low probability event, which causes problems and which causes social breakdown.
Yes.
So I'm very worried that society is fragile and brittle, and international relations will remain very tense and dangerous so long as massive inequalities persist and even get aggravated between the countries like those in Africa and those like the US and Europe. So that's one. So that's my pessimistic view. But if you ask about more optimistic vision, I suppose one distinctive feature of astronomers is that they are especially aware of just how long the future is. What I mean is that unless you're born in Kentucky or part of the Muslim world, you are aware that we're the outcome of nearly 4 billion years of Darwinian evolution. But most people who are happy to understand Darwinian evolution, they still somehow think we are the culmination.
Mm-hmm.
And no astronomers could believe that, because astronomers know that the sun is less than halfway through its life. It's had 4.5 billion years. It's got about 6 more to go. And the universe may go on expanding forever. And I like to quote Woody Allen, who said, "Eternity is very long, especially towards the end."
and we really are just a mote of dust.
And so I think one of the main themes of my book is that this century is special. It's the first when one species, namely the human species, has the future of the planet in its hands. We can screw up badly and destroy future potential, whereas on the other hand, we can trigger the transition from biological evolution to perhaps a new kind of evolution, a kind of secular intelligent design where post-humans here on Earth and far beyond will hugely surpass human capacities. And this is a very exciting prospect. And we can then think that we're not even the halfway stage in the emergence of complexity and wonderful beauty in the universe. So that's what cheers me up.
Any advice for those who struggle, you know, for those who really know what's going on in the world and struggle to maintain that optimism that you so beautifully wrote into your book? How do we do it?
Well, I think it certainly helps to think about these things, to look up at the stars and not worry too much about short-term things, but also to campaign as much as you can, depending on what kind of job you're in, what kind of authority you have, in order to increase the chance that we will get on the positive trajectory and not foreclose the option of that by crashing later in this century.
Well, on that note, Martin, Lord Martin Rees, I have to thank you so, so much for inviting me into your wonderful office.
It's a great pleasure to meet you, and thank you very much for the conversation.
Absolutely. And guys, everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy. Mm-hmm.